I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Mitt Romney, I should say, won big yesterday, dominating in all five primaries and has pretty much sewed up the Republican presidential nomination, unless something comes out of left field. So now the speculation turns to who will be Romney's running mate. Here's a sampling of pundits taken from Talking Points memo.
Paul Ryan, not so much. Rubio, not so much either.
Portman, as he's not scintillating.
I'm a big fan of Bob McDonald.
Senator from New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte.
Jeb Bush.
We know Romney needs women, and Haley is hot right now.
My head's exploding. Romney has begun the vetting process, but his team is staying mum about who's on the list. Joining us is Reed Wilson, editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline, also a columnist for National Journal. And Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks, Marty.
Let me begin with something you wrote, actually, this morning in National Journal. The Republican National Committee will move to formalize its ties to Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. What does that mean?
Well, the Republican National Committee, both party committees, I should say, are allowed to spend certain amounts of coordinated funds with the presidential campaigns that they work with. The RNC and the DNC effectively become wings of that party, the party's nominee. So what declaring Mitt Romney the presumptive nominee means is that he now has access to about $21 million in what's called the presidential trust, and they're going to set up a number of liaisons between various departments in Boston and Washington, D.C., so that the two groups are working together. You know, Romney has been focused on these primaries while the Republican National Committee has been focused on building the sort of infrastructure you need to win in November alongside President Obama and the DNC. So while Romney's been focusing on one thing, he's now got to sort of wrench himself over and focus on this other major task of building a national infrastructure. Now he has a group that's already been doing that and laid a good foundation for him.
So the general election has essentially begun?
The general election, for all intents and purposes, really began a few months ago, a few weeks ago, we'll call it, just to be fair. Romney's camp and the RNC have been coordinating on message and talking sort of behind the scenes in back channels for a couple of weeks now. Now they just get to make it formal and talk about it publicly.
Now, Mitt Romney was in Pennsylvania on Monday, and with him was Marco Rubio, senator from Florida. There has been some speculation about Rubio being a potential running mate. How do you understand what, I guess, what that visit was about? But how do you think Marco Rubio is playing among the I guess the folks that make these kinds of decisions?
Yeah. Well, let's take a step back and talk about the sort of how this process plays out. At the very beginning, everybody's got to figure out which candidate is going to do the best for the presidential nominee. They evaluate that using a couple of criteria. You know, first of all, who's going to maybe help bring a state geographically? Who's going to speak to a demographic that the presidential nominee needs to make some inroads with? Who needs to who can bolster their argument, the presidential nominee's argument? A great example of that is Bill Clinton chose Al Gore, a very similar candidate to himself, as a way to sort of amplify his message of a new generation back in 1992. And sort of above all, the same, it's the same pledge that doctors take when they take the Hippocratic Oath. Above all, do no harm. Sarah Palin was a choice who filled a lot of those categories in 2008, but she did a lot of harm to the ticket. The first thing that Mitt Romney's team is going to be looking for is somebody who doesn't hurt his chances in November. So Rubio is one of, I think, about four people on the extreme short list at the moment. Now, of course, other people can be added to that, and people like Sarah Palin and Dick Cheney weren't necessarily on the short lists to begin with, so we can still have surprises. But I think the short list starts with Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, and Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, who has become one of the big sort of rising stars within the party. Rubio's trip to Pennsylvania was a big moment, and it came at a big time for him. If anything, he has been the best at leveraging this spotlight that's been shown on him. He's young, he's Hispanic, he's conservative, he gets the party base excited, and he has come in just a couple years in the U.S. Senate, made a big name for himself. His visit to Pennsylvania, a swing state, or a possible swing state at least, is sort of the a trial run, an opportunity to, for Americans to see Romney and Rubio standing next to each other, an opportunity for all of us in the media to talk about Rubio as a potential vice presidential candidate, and you know the opportunity for maybe for Mitt Romney to get to know the guy a little better. A big part of this is about sort of cohesion between the top of the ticket and the number two.
Why is this though a job that everyone says they don't want?
There are a few rules about how one runs for vice president.
The kind of etiquette, and, I guess, of this.
Exactly. You have to say that you have that your current job is the best job in the whole world, even though that may not be true. You've got to say that you just want to focus on one thing now, whether that's winning re-election or helping your party or helping the nominee win the White House, whatever. You're only focused on one thing, and you have to. And heaven help you if you say or give any indication that you're interested in the job, because that almost automatically disqualifies you. So we'll hear Rubio and McDonnell and Portman and Ryan and everybody else all say that they're not interested in actually being vice president. I would just point people to the last time Joe Biden said that, which was about 2 weeks before President Obama picked him as the vice presidential nominee. So, yeah, everybody says that they're not interested, but the moment you get a phone call from your party's presidential nominee saying, hey, will you serve with me, or will you serve, your country, serve your president, it's really hard to turn down.
Well, you mentioned Marco Rubio, and you also mentioned Rob Portman, Ohio senator. And Rob Portman's name comes up from several different camps. What do you think his appeal would be?
Well, Rob Portman's appeal is sort of exactly the opposite of Marco Rubio's appeal. While Rubio is a new and fresh face, Portman is somebody with gravitas who's been around Washington, D.C. for a long time. He was served in Congress. He now serves in the U.S. Senate. In between, he served as George W. Bush's head of the Office of Management and Budget. He is a serious person who talks about serious legislation. He was one of the key Republican negotiators on the debt ceiling deal, the super committee, and was talking seriously about trying to find some kind of big compromise. So if Mitt Romney wants credit for making a presidential decision, and of course the vice presidential pick is your first presidential decision as a nominee, the question becomes how do you sort of make that decision with gravitas? And if that's the ultimate answer, the ultimate sort of idea that Romney wants to get across, he should pick somebody like Portman, who has this deep well of knowledge and long record of activism in Washington, D.C. The goal of a vice president is to pick somebody who is able to step into the job. There are few people sort of better on this, on any kind of list, who would be better qualified to step into the job of being president of the United States of America than somebody like Rob Portman. On the other hand, McDonnell and Paul Ryan all represent this new generation of Republican leaders that are rising. This is the opportunity for them to shine and to be sort of the next face of the Republican Party. And Portman, as I said, is a guy who's been around for a long time. So the drawback, his strength may be, in fact, his drawback. The fact that this guy's been here for a long time and, he's part of the swamp and everything that's wrong with Washington, D.C. So there's that counter argument to his best, the best argument for Rob Portman.
And it sounds like that creates a challenge for Mitt Romney, which is that he's got to try to solidify his base with a choice, assumingly, but also be able to appeal to moderates within the party or those people that are undecided. And I think it'll be interesting to see how he reconciles that if choosing a vice president is someone that can speak to that internal struggle within that party.
Well, I think that there's not much that Romney needs to do to solidify the base. The idea that Republicans are going to stay home or sit on their hands because they don't think Romney is conservative enough, I think sort of misses the larger point that there is nobody on earth who is better for turning out Republican voters than Barack Obama. Republican voters can't stand the guy, and they will turn out to try to vote him out of office. So the idea that Romney needs to sort of dive back to the right to pick a vice presidential nominee to shore up his base, I'm not sure that necessarily is the overriding concern right now. However, on the other hand, there's a difference between just turning out and going out and raising money or knocking on doors or doing the sort of legwork it takes to become president of the United States. So if Romney's pick inspires the conservative base, inspires them to sort of show up at the polls, that can be a good thing. However, they tried that last last time around with Sarah Palin, one of the things that I've found in my reporting about the presidential the vice presidential pick is just how much Republicans have been informed by Sarah Palin's candidacy back in 2008. They feel very much that because she was so new and fresh, the sort of the media glommed onto that which was unknown, and so instead of being able to talk about what she would do as president or as vice president and the McCain ticket, she was bogged down answering questions about Trooper Gate in Alaska or about her views on her husband's membership in a third party up in Alaska. So there were the new fresh thing is great and it excites voters. It also excites the media, and no politician is perfect, and there's going to be some scandal to talk about in everybody's past. That really informs Republicans as they're thinking about who should be the nominee this time around.
But didn't she also break an unwritten rule, which is you don't want to overshadow your partner, the presidential candidate?
That is exactly right. And as a matter of fact, as I take a look at the top four candidates on the short list, it's hard to see how Paul Ryan or Marco Rubio especially doesn't overshadow Mitt Romney. I mean, Mitt Romney is not a terribly exciting personality. He's not the leader of this of a movement like President Obama was 4 years ago. He's the Republican nominee. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to engender all this excitement. So it's sort of hard to figure out who would not overshadow Romney. If that is the overwhelming concern, then I think Rob Portman again gets a little bit of a boost because he's a known quantity who's very calm and who's going to maybe bolster the base, but he won't thrill anybody, nor will he be much of a surprise either.
Well, Reid, Chris Christie said he doesn't want the job, but nonetheless, if he were actually interested, do you think he is the kind of candidate that Mitt Romney would want in that he brings this kind of energy and excitement to the race?
Chris Christie said, beyond saying he didn't want it, the one thing that he said that I thought was the smartest was that he can't envision himself ever being the number two. And I think that's exactly right. Chris Christie is a loud, gregarious figure who goes after the teachers' unions and makes enemies hand over fist. And, he doesn't really care that he makes enemies because he thinks he's right and he's going to go out and fight for what he believes in. That's a great thing for a Republican in the Northeast, somebody who needs to, sort of create their own independence, create their own brand if they want to get reelected and if they want to actually implement any of their policies. On the other hand, it is a very bad thing for a vice presidential nominee, as somebody who's supposed to be so supportive of the ticket. So let's not forget, too, that Chris Christie's team was at least partially flirting with the idea of jumping in the presidential race late, too.
That's right.
When Romney's campaign didn't look like it was taking off and sort of people were clamoring for another option. So that might lead to some uncomfortable questions. The biggest problem, though, for Christie is that, as he himself put it, his temperament is not that of a subordinate.
Well, to be continued. Reid Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting us started as we talk about the Veep stakes, such as they are. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks a lot, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline, also columnist for National Journal. Getting us started as we talk about speculation about a running mate for Mitt Romney. We'll also talk about the role of running mates in the past, and we have a guest waiting in the wings. And we'll be taking your calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AM 1112 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. On now at 1812 Productions, Boston Marriage, the celebrated comedy by renowned American playwright David Mamet. Boston Marriage stars Grace Gunglefsky and Suzanne O'Donnell as a most unconventional couple in this comedy full of sharp barbs, intense loyalty, and more than a little scandal. Boston Marriage runs through May 20th only. Tickets and info at www.1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain. It's the third day of the spring membership drive here at WHYY. We depend on our listeners just like you for about half of our funding, and that only works if you make a pledge of support. That's the model that has kept WHYY strong and growing for more than half a century, and that's how it will work for the next 50 years. Please make a pledge right now by calling 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks very much.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at ChristianaCare.org/heartleaders.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. Today we're talking about vice presidential politics. What does a candidate look for in a running mate? How does their relationship work or not work on the trail or in the White House? Who have been some memorable veeps and some notable VP candidates? And joining us is Joel Goldstein. He's a professor of law at St. Louis University School of Law, author of a book called The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. And Joel Goldstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's good to be with you.
And our lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. I'm not sure whether all this veep speculation is just press and pundits trying to entertain themselves now that the primary season is essentially over, or whether it is a big deal. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it really is a big deal. But to some extent, there's a void in our political reporting and in the appetite that we have for political news, and that is that once the presidential nomination is resolved, the biggest story becomes who's going to be the running mate. And really, I think since the change, the move to a primary and caucus system, which really started in the mid-1970s, we've had this long period of time where the focus has been on who the vice presidential candidate will be for weeks, even months before the convention. Right. It used to be that the beginning and the end of the vice presidential process was the third night of the convention after the presidential nomination was resolved. Now we have several months of it, and that gives us a lot of time for speculation and for pundits to pontificate, but also for Governor Romney and his team to do the work that they need to do.
Do voters care? And I realize that's kind of a broad question. We're talking voters over time. But is the vice president, that selection, is that important to voters?
One of the common myths is that it's not. But I think it's true that not many people in November are going to go into the polls and say, you know, I really can't stand Governor Romney or President Obama, but I love his running mate, and so I'm going to vote for that ticket. But it's important in a couple of ways. First, it's important because the selection sends a message about the selector. When Governor Romney makes his choice, that will tell us something about what he values and how he goes about making decisions. It's the first presidential decision that a presidential candidate makes in most cases. The other thing is that if you have a close election where swing voters are relatively indifferent between the competing presidential candidates, it's possible that the vice presidential choice may swing a small percentage of voters, but a percentage that may be decisive. I think in 1976 that Walter Mondale's participation on the Democratic ticket really was very important in Jimmy Carter carrying Ohio and Pennsylvania and in a few other states where Mondale was very popular and where he campaigned pretty heavily. So it can make a difference.
I was talking with Reed Wilson about Sarah Palin, and of course that was John McCain's pick for the last presidential run. He certainly got a bump out of the convention, but then it seemed like that everything pretty much went haywire after that.
Well, I think you're right, Marty. I mean, the Palin pick was exciting at the time. It mobilized the base who had misgiving about Senator McCain. It was a fresh new face that really brought some excitement to his campaign. And in fact, in some of the polls, he drew even or even went ahead of Senator Obama. But over time, it also mobilized the Democratic base. And it really cost Senator McCain his argument that he would put America first. It was hard to argue that Governor Palin was among the Republicans who was really of presidential caliber. And as she began to do media interviews and with Charlie Gibson and Katie Couric and others, it became pretty evident that to a lot of people, including many Republicans, that she wasn't ready to be a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Did that then put the focus on this role of the vice president, which is that they have to have the kind of credentials and experience to fill in if, you know, heaven forbid, something would happen to the president?
I think that's right. I mean, the vice president really, since the beginning, has been the first presidential successor. And we've had 9 instances in our history where vice presidents have become president upon the death or the resignation, in the case of Richard Nixon, of the president. We've also had instances where presidents have been disabled, and that raises another specter. So there's always been that sort of heartbeat away aspect of the job. The other thing that's happened is that really since the Mondale vice presidency in 1977, the vice president really has become a very significant office. It's really been transformed so that the vice president works in the White House, is part of the president's inner circle, is a close presidential advisor, handles major troubleshooting assignments for the president, sometimes takes on responsibility for specific areas, really extends the president's ability to do his or her job. So it's not the nothing office of much of American history. It really is one of the most significant positions in the country now.
In fact, in your book, you say that really is the start of the modern, I guess, vice presidency when Carter chose Mondale.
I think that's right. I mean, Carter really had thought a lot about the office and really had a strong belief that it was wasteful and it was even unethical for the vice president not to be engaged. The Mondale and the people around him really thought, well, how do we make this work? How do we make an office work that has never worked before? And Mondale came up with the idea, really, that rather than taking on specific ongoing assignments like other vice presidents had tried to do, that the way to be successful was to become a important presidential advisor who had access to go into the Oval Office and say, I disagree with you about X or Y or so forth. And that's really the role that Mondale played. I mean, Carter agreed to it and Mondale played it. And since then, every vice president has really, to greater extent or more or less, has played that role. I mean, some more so than others, right. But they've all had access and they've all been significant figures.
And I do want to talk about some of those partnerships, but let me ask you what I asked Reed Wilson, which is, why then is this a job that everyone says that they don't want? You know, they're always trying to ramp down the speculation.
Yeah, well, I listened in on your interview with him, and I pretty much agree with his analysis. I mean, I think to some extent, it's that's the etiquette of it. You don't want to get way out there and sort of lust for the job and then be turned down. That doesn't look good at home. Also, there's a strategic aspect in it. I mean, sometimes playing a little bit hard to get makes you more attractive. Some of them may actually not want to be vice president. Some of them may feel, for whatever reason, perhaps they have something in their record, or perhaps they have a family situation that they really don't want to go through the vetting process. But it's helpful to be considered as one of the prime contenders. It looks good back home, and it right. may help set them up for a presidential run. The other aspect is that you're auditioning for a number two position, and it's not good strategy to try and pressure and to send a message to the presidential nominee and the people around him that this is likely to be somebody who's going to be out there, pounding his own drum or her own drum, but rather to be somebody who's a team player. So for all of those reasons, I think people try and indicate that they're not interested.
A very complicated courtship that's going on.
That it is.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Joel Goldstein, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about the vice presidency, handicapping the race for the vice presidency. He's written a book called The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. He's also a professor of law at University School of Law. You can tell I'm not from St. Louis. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm thinking about Carter, which, of course, takes us back to the 70s. And today we live in a much more diverse country, racially, ethnically diverse. How do you think that makes this choice even more interesting?
Well, I think that, Governor Romney, any presidential candidate has to make the choice based upon the context in which he or she is deciding in, and also has to make it with reference to what are his particular strengths and weaknesses, what are his or her needs. And so to that extent, I'm sure that Governor Romney and his team are looking at the fact that some polls indicate that he's running poorly among women voters, particularly single women voters, that he's running poorly among Hispanic voters. So that those are the sorts of issues that one has to consider. I think the demographic diversity does play a part. By the same token, increasingly the presidential race ends up being a contest in maybe 25 states that are deemed to be competitive or that are leaning one way or the other. So there's also sort of a focus of, well, how does one strengthen his or her position in those key battleground states? It's not any longer a 50-state competition, if it ever was, but it's much more one that tends to be focused both geographically as well as demographically.
And I'm going back to 2008 when candidate Obama chose Joe Biden from Delaware. A state with very few delegates and not a big player the way some of these other states are.
Right. And, it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting is every year every 4 years when we go through this vice presidential speculation, people invariably raise different possibilities or possible contenders based upon the fact that they come from a large state or a large competitive state. And if you look at our recent history, people are virtually never chosen to be the running mate because they come from a big state. As you point out, Joe Biden was from Delaware and Sarah Palin from Alaska, and there have been lots of examples. Dick Cheney was from Wyoming, one of the safest of Republican states. So there are very few instances in recent times where somebody has been chosen from a large or competitive state, and often when they are chosen from a large or competitive state, it's not because the thought is that they're going to help in that state. It's for other reasons. For instance, William Miller was Barry Goldwater's running mate, was a congressman from New York. Geraldine Ferraro was a congresswoman from New York. Jack Kemp had been a congressman from Buffalo. But they weren't chosen by the people who chose them in order to carry New York. If Mondale wasn't going to carry New York in 1984, he wasn't going to have a chance of winning. And Goldwater and Dole had no thought that they were going to carry New York. So the fact that somebody comes from a big state isn't what makes them an attractive vice presidential candidate. It may help if they meet other criteria, but it's not what ends up being decisive.
How did Dick Cheney change the vice presidency?
Well, Dick Cheney in some ways, I think, represented the triumph of the vice presidency, because before Dick Cheney, virtually everybody who wanted to be vice president did so because they saw it as a stepping stone to the presidency. Dick Cheney came into the vice presidency with the idea that that it would represent the pinnacle of his political ambitions. He didn't want to run for president, and in fact, he didn't run for president. So what the Cheney vice presidency said is this office has become significant enough so that somebody who had risen to in the House leadership, who had been Secretary of Defense, who had been the chief executive at Halliburton, saw this job as being attractive enough to take it on. I think as vice president, he really operated, at least for the first term, as something of sort of a chief operating officer of the government, and particularly after 9/11, when national security issues became paramount, mm-hmm. and he had this enormous experience both as Secretary of Defense and in other positions, and Governor Bush was really, or President Bush was relatively new to these issues. I think the Cheney vice presidency became very significant.
Do you think he had more authority on some decisions? I mean, do you think he, in certain ways, he was acting as de facto president, making some of these decisions?
I think the idea that Dick Cheney was president or co-president is an exaggeration. I think that George W. Bush was always the president, and I think that became evident in a number of instances. I mean, Dick Cheney didn't want to go back to the United Nations, and he didn't want to go to Congress to get authorization to go to Iraq. President Bush decided to do both of those things. Dick Cheney didn't want Donald Rumsfeld to be removed as Secretary of Defense, and he wanted Scooter Libby to be pardoned, and Rumsfeld was removed, and Libby wasn't pardoned. So I think there were a number of instances where Cheney ended up being on the losing side of issues, particularly in the second term. So I think he had a lot of influence. I think President Bush valued his advice, and I think that because President Bush had a little bit more of a hands-off operation or style of operation, or he tended to delegate more, I think that created room and opportunity for Vice President Cheney that some vice presidents haven't had. But I think that President Bush was always the president.
Do you think, and even beyond the Bush-Cheney, looking at some of these other partnerships in the White House, that it's the president who gives the vice president the authority or the responsibility for certain issues or policies?
Sure. I think the vice president doesn't have any significant role other than what the president gives him or her. I think in practice, it would be pretty hard for the next president not to include the vice president as a close presidential advisor. I mean, every vice president since Mondale's had a weekly private lunch with the president, an Oval Office, a West Wing office, the right to walk in and participate in Oval Office meetings. It'd be very hard for the next president not to continue those customs. And those are a source of enormous opportunity and opportunity to be influential. But whether the vice president takes on reinventing government as Al Gore did at Bill Clinton's request or takes on responsibility for bilateral relations with Russia as Gore did, or whether it takes on the energy task force as did Cheney or some of the things that Vice President Biden has taken on, that's really based upon the presidential assignment.
Let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Joel Goldstein about the vice presidency. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. Sunday, April 29th, I'll host a Madame Butterfly dinner. Miss Butter, formerly of New York City Opera, will perform selections from Puccini's masterpiece and traditional Japanese numbers. Margaret Kuo, support WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. Opening May 22nd, the new hospital is being built with all single-patient rooms and has been designed with innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a new rapid-response emergency room and CHOP docs to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Opening May 22nd. More at PrincetonHCS.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Are you a member of WHYY? Have you made a pledge of support to ensure the programs that you enjoy and rely on remain strong? Radio Times produces 500 shows a year covering a wide range of topics. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. What's that worth? $50 a year? $100? $200? You decide. Make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499. You can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Mitt Romney won big yesterday and has pretty much sewed up the Republican presidential nomination. Now speculation is turning to who will be his running mate. We're talking with Joel Goldstein about the vice presidency. He's the author of a book called The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution, professor of law at St. Louis. I don't know why I keep doing that. I want to be in New Orleans, I guess, at St. Louis University School of Law. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Who do you think Mitt Romney should pick as his vice president? And another question for you, should President Obama stay with Joe Biden? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Joel, picking up on that last question to our audience, do you think President Obama will stick with Joe Biden? Any way to speculate on that?
I think that's a done deal. In fact, I wrote something, about more than a year ago, saying that all the speculation was sort of Washington chatter. I think that by all appearances, Biden's been a very involved and influential vice president, and there's no indication that President Obama isn't perfectly happy with him. I think that he's helpful in a lot of areas where the president needs help, and it's very difficult to replace a vice president, even if a president wants to do so. I think George H.W. Bush may have seen that in 1992, and Dwight Eisenhower in 1956. But I think in this instance, there's no indication that the president wants to make a change.
In fact, you even said that Joe Biden is perhaps as, maybe differently, but as powerful as Dick Cheney as a vice president.
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to make a comparison, but yes, I think Biden has been very significant, both in terms of I think he's taken sort of a modified version of the Mondale model as sort of the principal or is a presidential advisor and troubleshooter. If you look at the countries that he's traveled to, he hasn't been primarily somebody who would go to funerals and inaugurations, although he's done some of that. I mean, he's been to the major hotspots in the world and countries that where the United States has major issues and relationships with. He was involved in implementing the Recovery Act, chairing the Middle Class Task Force, involved in getting the budget negotiations. He's worked on a number of issues to try and strike compromises on important issues with Republicans in Congress. So I think he's played a very important role, in a different role, a more political role than Vice President Cheney did, but a very important one.
Well, and he has that blue-collar cred, a guy who lived in part in Scranton, Pennsylvania. It seems to me an important player on the campaign trail as well.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, he spent a lot of time, as you say, campaigning. He's a chief surrogate for the president, and there are a lot of audiences where he plays better than the president does, and blue-collar Democrats who had some misgivings about the president, but were very positive about Vice President Biden, and in part because of that Scranton, Pennsylvania origins and his whole life's history.
He's known to go off script. It doesn't seem to bother the president too much, but you know, I guess that's Joe Biden.
I think it's viewed as being part of his brand. It's understood. It's not a surprise. And actually, those instances seem to have happened less as the term has gone on. And I think the vice president perhaps has been a little bit more careful and But I think on a number of issues, I mean, for instance, on Afghanistan, he apparently was somebody who was going into the decisions and was saying, was not afraid to articulate a different viewpoint than some of the other advisors. And that's very important for a president. There's a tendency for presidential advisors to say what they think the president wants to hear. The vice president can serve as somebody who can talk truth to power. He or she's the one advisor that the president can't remove until their joint terms end. So the vice president has a certain amount of security. And the president, a president has a dependence on a vice president as well as the vice president has dependence on the president. The vice president can do a lot of things for the president, can help the president in terms of reelection. And so although the vice president, I think, is more dependent on the president than vice versa, the dependency really does, to some extent, run both ways.
And is there a notable dysfunctional relationship that you've looked at between a president and vice president, one that you really didn't serve either of them or the country?
Well, I think there have been a number. I mean, I think the one that really comes to mind is Nixon and Agnew. I think, you know, Nixon developed contempt for Agnew and didn't include him in anything. And in the second term after he really wanted to dump Agnew for the second term, and he wanted to put John Connally, who was his Treasury Secretary, on the ticket. And he came to the conclusion that Agnew was sufficiently popular with the conservative wing of the Republican Party that dumping him would simply present a sort of an unhappiness in the Republican Party, and it just wasn't worth the effort to Nixon. But when they were reelected, he didn't give Agnew anything to do, and finally he suggested to Agnew that his role ought to be the chairman of the bicentennial celebrations to take place in 1976, of the 200th year of the Declaration of Independence and the Revolutionary War and so forth. Agnew would fancy himself as the next president of the United States, didn't think that doing a national history seminar was sort of what he should be doing. So I think there was a real contemptuous relationship.
And did he, Agnew, carry out those duties?
Well, Agnew didn't last very long. was on the verge of being indicted, indicted for tax evasion in connection with accepting kickbacks as governor of Maryland, and he ultimately resigned from as vice president in October of 1973. So he didn't have much time to do anything.
Take care of that. What about Kennedy Johnson?
Well, I mean, that was there were instances where Kennedy used Johnson and, I mean, included Johnson, for instance, towards the end in terms of talking about civil rights and how to get civil rights legislation through. And Johnson made some really impressive speeches about civil rights. I think one might have been at Gettysburg in 1963. But Johnson was tremendously frustrated as vice president. He wasn't in the inner circle. He wasn't accustomed to being a number two. He was, you know, a consummate number one person. And the Kennedy people, it was an awkward relationship for Kennedy, too. I mean, Kennedy had been a backbencher in the Senate when Johnson was perhaps the most powerful majority leader in recent times. And so it was a frustrating relationship. Kennedy, you know, sort of manufactured foreign trips for Johnson to go on. But Johnson wasn't in the inner circle and was frustrated at being sort of excluded and not having the levers of power at his fingers.
Well, we are talking about the vice presidency with Joel Goldstein, professor of law at St. Louis University School of Law, author of a book called The Modern American Vice Presidency. And he says in many ways that modern vice presidency began when Carter picked Mondale. And we're interested in who you think either Mitt Romney should pick or whether President Obama should pick somebody else. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 888-477-WHYY. Well, jumping from Kennedy Johnson to today, Joel, and I'm thinking about Mitt Romney, what about a woman? And in terms of how he needs to kind of complete the package here, do you think a woman should be on a short list?
It wouldn't surprise me if a woman is on the short list. The difficulty is trying to figure out who that person would be. My own view is that the first sort of threshold requirement that a presidential nominee has to think about is this person a plausible president? And I think that the challenge is that many of the women who are mentioned as prospective running mates are relatively new to sort of traditional feeder positions, senator, governor, member of the House of Representatives. They haven't really been, don't have that much experience. I'm thinking about, for instance, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley or New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez or Senator Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire. They've all been in office for a couple of years, roughly. And it may be that one of these people really is presidential, but it's a bit of a gamble to put somebody under the bright lights of a national campaign when they're that new. Because if they, you know, commit gaffes or if they don't appear to be ready for it, it impacts not only the public perception of them, but also the perception of the person who selected them. The woman who really is of tremendous stature who might be a possibility would be Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
I just scribbled her name down. Yes.
Yeah, but I mean the challenge there is the question is I think twofold. One is that I think in the past she's taken positions on issues like a woman's right to an abortion or affirmative action that are far to the left of the base of the Republican Party. Historically, people, including Governor Ridge of Pennsylvania, have been precluded from being a running mate because they were pro-choice. And yet Secretary of State Rice has indicated a greater receptivity to a woman having a right to terminate a pregnancy than is the standard sort of Republican position. So that would be one big obstacle to her being selected. The other one would be the question of whether or not Governor Romney really wants to take somebody who's so associated with President George W. Bush. I mean, President Bush left office as a very unpopular president. If he puts somebody from the Bush administration or who's associated with President Bush on the ticket, it sort of reminds people of that history and maybe reminds them that some of the economic problems didn't start with on January 20th, 2009. So I think that's the other obstacle that Secretary Rice might have, assuming she's interested, and she's always indicated that she's not interested.
Well, does that also, do you think, disqualify Jeb Bush? You know, again, another name that was bandied about, but whether he's got the Bush problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think he has it in a different way. I saw that you know, George Will recently wrote a column where he said that Jeb Bush shouldn't be considered because if he were considered, it would mean that something like 7 of the last 10 presidential races there'd been a Bush on the Republican ticket, and it would seem sort of dynastic. But I think he does make that association with even more so, you know, although he's otherwise a very able and attractive person. I think it raises an issue with respect to Senator Portman, who, you know, I think Reed Wilson's right, is really one of the people who's viewed as sort of presidential, a serious figure on those being talked about.
Well, Joel, if you don't mind, just hold on to that thought for 1 second. I just have to do a quick ID. Joel Goldstein, our guest today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Picking up on the Portman issue, and I think this is something that Reed Wilson was also talking about, which is, I think, a particular challenge for the Republican Party, which is how to, you know, keep the base energized, but also fold in some of these more moderate voters.
I mean, I think you've really hit part of Governor Romney's dilemma, is that the base has misgivings about him, has historically. Even looking at the returns yesterday from five sort of eastern states, his numbers seem to be lower than traditionally people's numbers are after they win, after they've in effect clinched the nomination. So the base has misgivings about Governor Romney. He's got to appeal to them. By the same token, he's got problems with independent voters in swing states, particularly, and he's got to appeal to that group too. And so he really walks a fine line. Mm-hmm. By the same token, a lot of our speculation now is uninformed because we don't know what the context is going to be in July and August when he really gets down to making this decision. A lot can change between now and then, and whether it does will help shape ultimately what his decision will be.
And do you think, and we're almost out of time here, I know that you know, Hillary Clinton's name was tossed around, obviously, on the Democratic side. How do you read some of that speculation?
Well, I don't know why it keeps coming up.
Neither, actually, but yes, go ahead.
But I mean, I think she's been enormously popular as Secretary of State. But I think to some extent her popularity is because she's been, she's a very able person, but she's also been removed from the political fray. If she were having to defend some of the issues that the president and vice president are, it would have an impact. But she's the sort of person who it would make very little sense for me that she would want to be vice president. If she wants to be president, she says she doesn't. But assuming she wants to run in 2016, she's the sort of person who has the stature that she doesn't need to be vice president to position herself to run in 2016. Most of these other people who are being talked about on the Republican side, really, the vice presidency would give them a huge boost towards the presidential run, as it did with Al Gore, George H.W. Bush, or Walter Mondale.
Well, on that note, I'm sorry to do that. On that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, I really enjoyed it, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Joel Goldstein is the author of The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.